made a dog's dinner. I'm talking about the hierarchy problem. And so I thought I'd clear that up a bit more. Seeing as it's the prime motivation hierarchy for supersymmetry, at low energies, let's just tell you what the deal is. So scalar propagator has a pole in its four momentum squared, which we identify with the mass, okay? And that's a generic way of defining the mass of the particle, even when it's not a tree level, okay, when we have a different expression there. So when we look at a loop corrected propagator, and we add some loops, we get a different expression. And actually, we get one So at one loop, we get something like this. A and B are order one real constants. There may be functions of the couplings. Okay, so now we can say, well, what's the loop corrected mass that we associate with this propagator? And it's just, you know, at the pole. Therefore, so in terms of the original tree level mass, little m, and some heavy particle mass which is travelling around in the loop, big M, this is the kind of expression we get. So big M is heavy particle in the loop. Okay, and this is after renormalization and all that stuff. Okay, so these are the finite corrections. So what we see here is this logarithm. Supposing m is huge. Supposing we're talking about the Higgs, and this little m is 100 GeV, but big M is the largest mass scale in the theory. It's probably M Planck. We know that there's some mass scale M Planck. So there ought to be some heavy states associated with it. So, a logarithm of M Planck is, 30 or something. We're dividing it by some small number, for some large number, so that's no great shakes. But here, we have a huge correction to the mass squared of the Higgs at tree level. Okay. So all this business about quadratic divergences, it's slightly confusing. What it's telling you is that this heavy particle mass actually is the cutoff to the theory. We're not really talking about cancelling divergences. It just tells you that when you in a renormalizable theory, when you calculate the finite corrections, you will get quadratic dependence on the masses of the particles in the loop. And that's what's really dependent. So even though we sort of we find out what behavior the loop has by considering going to the limit of large momentum with a cutoff, really we're interested in finite corrections, and this just tells us that we're going to get m squared corrections, not just log m corrections. Okay. Yeah.
The constant k, is that positive or negative? If
n is
very large,
yeah,
the mass squared would be a negative number,
or
a is positive.
Let me see, at the moment it's not specified. Actually, it depends on whether it's a fermion, or this is just a one loop thing. And so actually A will contain the sum of lots of diagrams, some scalars and fermions. The scalars have a plus sign, fermions have a minus sign, depends which one's bigger. So it can take either sign, in general.
So this big M is the mass of the particle running in the loop?
Yes. So So this may be a different. So if we're interested in Higgs outside, this is some different particle, say, a heavy particle in the loop.
But this cutoff is then of a different scale possibly than the mass of the particle.
Yeah, so what this cutoff behavior is just, I mean, really, this particle mass is the cutoff.
Okay, because we're assuming maybe heavy states after that.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So all of this quadratic divergence business is just to see, actually, when you have particles in the loop, what's the sensitivity to the particle mass? That's the only reason we're interested in this at the moment. Because we're talking about renormalizable theories. And, yeah.
Sorry. When you compute all the one loop corrections and for A, and you will they always come out to be positive or negative, or will you ever end up with with mass squared equals negative number?
Oh, see.
Because that would be odd.
You can do. And in fact, if you remember, the Higgs mechanism has a negative mass squared. And that's if that particle has quantum numbers, that triggers spontaneous symmetry breaking. Yeah. So it's like an effective mass of a Lagrangian. It's not really a physical mass of a particle. It just means you've expanded around the wrong vacuum of the field. And so you expand around the right vacuum and extract the physical states. Okay, so that's good.
Another question?
Yes.
Sorry, if the Higgs is the only massive particle, what are the heavy M particles in the loop?
Yeah, okay, good question. They're particles, so these ones are particles associated with heavy physics. So we don't know what they are, right? We haven't produced them yet. So, but candidates for it are, we know that there's some physics at the Planck scale because we have this huge mass scale. That just doesn't come out of nowhere. There must be some states associated with that scale. Maybe, at this scale, quantum gravity is important, admittedly. So maybe we can't just rely on these simple field theory estimates of calculating loops there. Maybe for some reason they just go away because of quantum gravity. But then the one that we're interested in is going to be, the next highest energy scale. So it could be some particles associated with the breaking of a grand unified theory, or you know, if grand unified theories aren't right, it's just the highest one. So this argument is not watertight, okay? Supposing you just have the standard model all the way up to the Planck scale, quantum gravity takes over, it doesn't give you quadratic divergences because we don't understand quantum gravity, then you can forget this argument, okay? It's an indication. If you have grand unified theories, though, you do have a problem, yeah. Yeah, but you know that there's something heavier because of the Planck mass, but yeah, maybe field theory, you can't rely on field theory for the Planck mass. Yeah, that's right. And, you know, it doesn't rely, someone mentioned last time, so this is log energy scale. So we have mz, we could have m Planck, m gut. So let's take the gut to be, say, SO10. You know, there can be lots of breaking scales, as I think Nima told you. Whatever. So then we have standard model. And below this, you know. Okay, so the dominant corrections to the Higgs mass we're going to get are going to be from the largest mass where you can trust field theory, okay? And, so whatever scales you have here, the dominant one is the biggest one. Good. All right, so this is only a problem with scalars. If we look at the electron mass corrections, then, so for fermions and stuff, you... You just get a logarithm. So, you know, that's no great shakes. Good. All right. So I just wanted to clarify that bit. So now what we're going to do... Yes, sorry.
So when people say that this is a problem with the mass of the Higgs, is that because the Higgs is the only scalar particle?
Yes.
Okay.
It's the only scalar that we... supposedly know of, even though we haven't.
So any other scalar particle would also blow up?
Yes. All right. So at the end of this course, we're going to get to the minimal version of the supersymmetric version of the standard model. And so I thought what we'd do, just to get going, and so you've got some tutorial work for today, is to do a bit of revision on the standard model. Just for a sec, I just want to remind you of what states are in there. So in the gauge bosons, spin equals 1, we have some representations of the gauge groups. And I'm going to write a singlet as a 1. So, of course, we have our gluons, which I called G mu. So they're in a adjoint representation of SU3. That's 8-dimensional. They're singlets under SU2 left, and they're singlets, so they've got no charge under U1y. We have 3 SU2 bosons. These are called W's, okay? These aren't the same as the W plus and minus, okay, after electroweak symmetry breaking, but they're linear combinations of them with the hypercharged gauge boson. Make those. Okay, and then there's one hypercharge gauge boson, which is singlet of everything. Okay, this is just reminding you. And now we have the fermion sector. So after electroweak symmetry breaking, what happens is components of B mu and these W's mix up. And they also, you know, eat some of the scalar fields and the Higgs boson. And what pops out the other end are the massive W plus and minus, the Z, and the photon. Photon is a linear combination of B mu and W3, okay, turns out. And after that breaking, what happens is that the electric charge comes out to be the third generator of SU2. Okay, so this is diagonal generator of SU2. Plus the hyper... Okay, there's a convention where we write the hypercharge as y over 2. Don't ask me why. But, so the hypercharge plus this diagonal generator of SU2 gives us the electric charge. So, if you're trying to remember what hypercharges of fermions in the Standard Model are, just remember this fermion, this formula, and if you know the electric charges of the fields, you can work out what the hypercharge is. So let's give an example. So you have to remember that the left-handed quarks come, all the left-handed guys come in a doublet, U left, U left. Okay. So you pick one of these, pick this top one, up quarks. So protons have two up quarks and a down. The up quarks are charge, electric charge, plus 2/3. Okay. So that is equal to T3. So T3 is the third Pauli matrix divided by 2. Okay, so it's in the top component it's plus 1/2, and in the bottom component it's minus 1/2. So we've got the top component here, so that means we've got plus 1/2 plus y over 2. All right. So we know that y over 2 for this guy is a sixth. I'm going to label y over 2 to keep the convention straight. Okay, it's a quark. So, you can shout out. How many colors has it got? 3? Yeah.
Yep. It has 3 colors. But what does that mean? That we're putting a 3 in there? That's the adjoint representation.
No. Okay, so.
Yeah.
I'm confused, really. Oh, yeah? Huh? Y is the hypercharge. It's the quantum number of U1 in the Standard Model. Okay? And it gets, because U1, this after electroweak symmetry breaking, this hypercharge gets mixed up with the SU2. And so you get this relation between the electric charge, the SU2 generator charge, and the hypercharge. Okay, so you're asking, why have I written a 3 here under SU3, and what's that got to do with 3 colors? That means it's got 3 colors. Okay, so 3 is the fundamental representation of SU3. It means this thing gets an index on it, let's call it X, which goes 1, 2, 3. Okay, if I put 1 there, that means it's a red quark, 2 is green, 3 is blue, whatever colours you want to say.
So these numbers you're adding are the number of indices?
It's the numbers, yes. So if you put an index representing the colour, it's the dimension, the values that index can take.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the numbers on the board are representations of the group that they're under?
Yes. Okay. Sorry, I didn't make that clear enough. So this B, this is adjoint representation of SU3. All the gauge bosons have to be in adjoint reps. Okay, you get non-normalizable theories otherwise.
So you're writing down a list of particles in the Standard Model, and next each particle is a representation.
under each of the groups. Yeah. Yeah, thanks. I didn't explain that well enough. Representations of the groups. But this is, you know, what I want to get across to you, this isn't just about, whatever, some abstract group thing. This is really writing down the number of degrees of freedom. Because we don't just have one gluonic field, we have eight of them. I mean, there are really eight separate degrees of freedom. So B goes from 1 to 8. And it's 8 because 8 is the dimensionality under SU3. Okay, so under SU2, what would be the representation of this left-handed quark doublet? Anyone know? Two. Yeah, I mean, it's a doublet under SU2. And that's, you know, I can write this thing with another index, what am I going to call it? I now. Okay. And I equals 1 is the top component, and I equals 2 is the bottom. And that index is this fundamental index of SU2. Okay. So for, let's pick another quark, an upright quark. So what's its, what am I going to write here as its representation under SU3? Yeah, again, it's a quark, so it has a color, red, green, and blue. If it was an anti-quark, if I'd have written U right bar, then I would have to write a 3 bar here because it would have an anticolor. It would have a red bar, green bar, blue bar. Okay. What about SU2 left? Yeah, it's a singlet. It's all the right-handed fermions in the standard model are singlets. And what about U1Y? Any guesses? Four-thirds. Yeah, so, no, I should have explained better. So, this T3 is all of these generators, whenever you write them down, they're in the representation of the particle you're talking about. If the particle's a singlet, then the representation is 0. Okay? So, for right-handed guys, you don't have this. You know, T3 doesn't just annihilates the state. Or there is no T. The T3 is absent, is trivial. If T3 for an adjoint representation is a 3x3 matrix, okay? But for a two-dimensional representation, it's a 2x2 matrix. I mean, that's what representation means. It means, you know, let's write down a matrix which satisfies the group algebra. Now you can write down actually an infinite number of matrices with different numbers of rows and columns. But you know, if the dimensionality is 3, then you've picked a 3x3 representation of the group. Okay, so in this case, for the right-handed guys, y over 2 is just equal to the electric charge. Okay, and so this is plus 2/3. For a up quark. Okay, for the down right quarks, again, 3, 1, and the electric charge is equal to y over 2, which is minus 1/3. So these are all spin 1/2, of course. And then, so what about this, the left-handed charged leptons? What are their representation under SU3? 1, yeah. They don't have colour, so they don't see the colour at all. How about SU2? Yeah, so they're a doublet. Okay, and then this hypercharge? Minus 1/2. And then for the electron, right-handed electron, again, it's a singlet of those guys and has hypercharge minus one. Okay, so there we've got all of the matter particles. But then the other particle in the standard model of the field, oh, you guys can't see now, right? Damn. Okay, where can I put it? Let's make its own. So for those of you who can't see this bottom line, it reads 1, 1, minus 1. Okay, there's a Higgs doublet. Spin. So the Higgs doublet looks like that. So it's got no colour. It's a singlet representation under SU3. The doublet under SU2. And its hypercharge is plus. Okay, good. So, you know, we can write various bits of Lagrangian down. The Lagrangian of the pure gauge fields of the standard model look like this. What am I going to call that? The So, for instance, okay, so these are the SU2 gauge bosons, kinetic terms. So, we get the usual field strength tensor, and then there's a non-abelian piece, and for SU2 it looks like this. Okay, thank you. Thank you. So these are SU2 gauge fields. And then for this B is just the usual U1 field strength tensor. And then there's an equivalent one involving structure constants of SU3 for the gluons. Looks similar, okay, etc. And I wanted to write down a kinetic term for a generic fermion. So we could imagine this being a left-handed quark. So I'm going to write the left-handed quarks as psi, right? And they have an index I and x. So the convention with special unitary groups is to write anti-colour indices downstairs and colour indices upstairs. Okay. Psi J Y. So remember, I is SU2 and it goes from 1 to 2. X goes from 1 to 3. And it's color index. So we have delta I J. Okay. So now we have the gauge coupling of the hypercharge group times B mu gamma mu. Okay. And then, so for a left-handed quark, I'm going to substitute a sixth in for this y over 2, okay? But I want to show you what it's like in general, so for a general fermion. And then, right. This is an SU2 generator in the representation of psi. So for a left-handed quark, this is going to be a 2 by 2, well, actually, it's the Pauli matrices divided by 2. So it's 2 by 2 emission matrix. Delta yx. Okay. If the particle you're considering is right-handed, then you know, this generator for that particle is zero, okay, because the representation is the singlet. Okay, so I'm going to call the Gell-Mann matrices T prime. They're 3 by 3 representations of SU3. B goes from 1 to 8. J and okay, X, Y. So I'm writing out all the gory details of the interactions of the various gauge bosons with the fermions. Okay. And of course you have to sum over all the fermions. And I should have pointed out that there are 3 families of fermions as well. Okay, so of course there are various things to note. There's a summation convention over all indices. And because all the indices are soaked up in every term, when we do a gauge transformation on them, they'll all be invariant. It's just like Lorentz scalars, basically. If all of the Lorentz indices are summed over, then you have a scalar. It's invariant under Lorentz transformation. Same thing here, yeah.
So I and X, you said, were what again?
So I is SU2 fundamental, i.e. two-dimensional rep index. And X is SU3 fundamental rep index. So, you know, you could count it as 1, 2, 3, or red, green, and blue. This one is, you know, 1 or 2, or upper component of the doublet, lower component of the doublet.
So when you say SU2 is rep of 4, is that the 2 by 2?
That's
psi. Sorry,
so
rep hold. Excellent.
That makes a lot more
sense.
That does.
You thought that was a 4? Yeah,
yes,
that would be.
Yeah,
so.
That was really.
That's a sign. Oh, sorry, this. Yeah, okay.
And so those are 2 by 2.
Yeah, unless psi is a trivial rep of SU2, in which case it's 0.
So it's the same.
It's in the represent. Really, I should put, you know, psi subscripts here, because it's really the representation of the group of, you know.
And so then if you're a 1 under SU3, that just looks like, yeah, then you're like, the T prime B is a 0.
It's a 0.
Okay.
If it's singlet, you get it's a 0. It doesn't talk to color at all.
Blue one's not interacting.
Yeah, with leptons. Yeah.
Okay. Perfect.
Sorry, I'm not really sure I understand. So when you call a representation a number, that's in what? Like, if your representation is 3, that means
it's a 3-dimensional representation.
Okay.
Okay, that means you have an index on the field which goes 1, 2, 3, and they're really separate fields. I mean, they're separate degrees of freedom, and that means that that really means the three colours. So if we consider this right-handed up quark, so I'd have to write an index x which goes from 1, 2, 3 on the top of it, and they're separate fields. I mean, there's a red field which is x equals 1, and that's a separate degree of freedom to the blue field, x equals 2.
But okay, for the blue ones, you were 8. They're not 8 colors, right?
There are 8 color states of gluons. There really are 8. So we like to decompose them in terms of these fundamental ones. So we call them red, green bar, blue, red bar, whatever, because there's a colour and anti-colour. But basically there are 8 different colour states. That some of them are linear combinations of the, you know, red, green bars and so on. Yeah.
Sorry, I don't really understand why this diagram is just diagonal.
Why
do the gauge bosons have to do with SU2 at all? Why do they have any interaction with that?
The gluons.
These guys.
No,
the gluons.
Or
weren't the gluons?
They don't. That's what the singlet means.
Okay.
Right?
All right.
They don't. And in fact, you already know the fact that there are direct products here really means that you know, the gluons have nothing to do with the SU2 bosons, which have nothing to do with the UV bosons, before you break the symmetry. Good. So, Okay, when you expand out this F, the new term, of course, you're going to get cross products of 4 and 3 W fields, right? So each of those can have annihilation operators in them. So that describes trilinear and quartic gauge boson interactions. And here we annihilate fermion and we can produce one, and then we have whatever, either some gauge boson from the standard model. And so, oh, sorry, in general there can be a mass term here, but I've left that out. Actually, in the standard model there are no mass terms to begin with, so that's fine. Okay. I'm sorry? Yeah, this is the gauge coupling of U1Y. That's the gauge coupling of SU2. That's the gauge coupling of SU3. Yep.
You wouldn't be able to have chiral change.
No, that's right. That's why there's no mass term in the same. Okay, good. All right. So, a fun exercise to get you used to these representations and stuff is to think about the anomaly, which and the chiral anomaly, which I understand you've heard something about before. So the tutorial today is to prove that quarks have 3 colours. All right, so as you may remember, anomalies occur in, or can occur in chiral gauge theories, just like the standard model is, and they come from diagrams like this. So we stick 3 gauge bosons on the outside. The simplest example actually is if we make all of these hypercharged gauge bosons for now. Let's think about that example. So you can tell that there's going to be, they're divergent, right, these diagrams. They're actually logarithmically divergent, turns out. Okay, so you have to renormalize this theory, and we have to add some term to the Lagrangian which cancels this divergence. So the counterterm Lagrangian would look something like, you know, okay, there's some Lorentz structure and so on. But it's going to look like product of three B fields times some other stuff. Okay, that is not gauge invariant under U1. Remember, in U1 theories, there's no interactions between several B fields. So this breaks the hypercharge symmetry. And so that symmetry would be anomalous. In other words, it's not, it can't exist in the quantum theory. Unless, when you sum over all the fermions, these the log divergent terms cancel. So, in general, okay, remember that the fermions are all massless in the standard model. So we get some kinematic factor for these diagrams, which is the same for all fermions, okay, times, and if we have general gauge bosons here, you get kinematic factor, you get three gauge couplings multiplying it, and you get the trace. See, each of these vertices in general comes with a some kind of group representation of the group ij. So if I make this a general gauge boson which has adjoint rep A, and say the color, if it's a color, then the colors of the quarks in going and outgoing are ij, then actually what you get is from these two, summing these two diagrams, is some kinematic factor, which is the same for all fermions, times trace of TA times the anticommutator of TB and TC. Okay. For when we're considering hypercharged gauge bosons, these Ts are really just a number. It's just the hypercharge of the fermion going around in the loop. So for the Y cubed anomaly, oh, sorry, I should point out, there is chirality associated with these fermions, and so the only thing that the kinematic affects in the Dirac trace is that we get some over the left-handed fermions minus some over the right-handed fermions trace of TA psi TC. Okay, so there's a left-handed minus right-handed thing just from this Dirac trace. So for the Y cubed anomaly, this is proportional to the kinematic factor times gauge coupling of hypercharge cubed times the sum over the left-handed size psi I of yi cubed minus sum over the right-handed fermions yi over t cubed. Okay, so the first exercise for the tutorial is prove that for one family of fermions, this cancels in the standard model. Yeah. As the
U1,
yeah. Is it, yeah. Yeah. So let's suppose quarks are in representation N of SU3. In other words, we don't know there are three colors of quark. Let's say there are n colors. I mean, they could have been in SU3, actually, there's a six-dimensional representation, for instance. So they could have been in a different rep. And then prove that anomaly cancellation tells you that n equals 3. So this U1 cubed anomaly cancellation. So that involves looking at all these representations, summing over U1y cubed. So it's just a numerical exercise. But remember that if you have three colors of quarks, then there are three fermions going around in this loop for that field. Okay. So you have to take, or if there are n colors, you get a factor of n because there are n different degrees of freedom. And then that's quite quick. So for those of you that are really on the ball and get it really quickly, there's an extended problem, which is then prove that the anomalies cancel for all the different gauge groups that you can put in here in the standard model. So I could have, a gluon, an SU2 gauge boson, and U1 gauge boson, for instance. Okay, that's chiral as well. So that vertex between a U1 boson, SU2 boson, and a gluon, that also is not in the standard model, and so it breaks the gauge symmetry. So it better be zero. And actually, all other combinations where you have two U1s and one of the other one, and et cetera. So you have to use some looking George I and use some facts about the representations of the groups to do that. And that's the exercise for today. Okay. Right. I think we'll go on. I've got 10 minutes to start SUSY algebra and representations. I mean, this has taken a while, but I think it's worth it because it's important to know these bits and pieces of the group theory of the standard model. Okay. So let's look. So we're going to build up the SUSY algebra now and representations. So first, we look at Poincaré algebra and spinors. So under a Poincaré transformation, our spatial coordinates go to some transformed spatial coordinates, which are equal to a Lorentz transformation plus a translation. Okay, if I write E to mu nu, or as a matrix, in my conventions it's mostly minus zeros everywhere else, off diagonal, in flats, so this is in Minkowski space. And this lambda is defined such that in matrix notation. It should satisfy that. And its determinant is plus 1. The 0, 0 component is positive. And if that's the case, then lambda describes a proper orthochronous Lorentz transform. And that's written as SO 1,3 with a little arrow that's going up, showing that it's proper and orthochronous. So sometimes you want Lorentz transforms from the wrong side of the town. You want bad, improper ones. And they can be found from these guys by multiplying by parity operate, parity reversal, or time reversal. So parity reversal, as you know, reverses the spatial direction. So we just multiply by that. Time reversal just reverses the direction of the sign of the time, to quote a Prince album. I'm wondering whether to carry on. I guess we should stop here. I think everyone's exhausted. Okay, so what I'll do next time is write down the... that defines the Lorentz transform, but we need to write down the algebra of the Poincaré group, which I'll do. And then we want to get on to spinners to show how they crop up in this theory.